dancing in the apocalypse.
I gotta get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and sparkle, Neely, sparkle.
I know what some of your big city no bra wearing hairy legged women livers might say.
Hello, welcome to Maximum Film. As if you would say, it's episode 215, and I got nothing for that number. My name is Drea Clark. I'm hosting today because our usual host, Iffy Wadaway, is out this week. But we will be getting a voice message from him later with his specific and I'm sure entrancing thoughts on Nightmare on Elm Street 2. This episode is dropping right in the middle of Maximum Fun's Block Party, which is a celebration of the community of Max Fun and an opportunity to get to know other shows on the network. So if you are joining us for the first time, welcome! Hello, come in, make yourself comfortable. We are, and in quotes, this is our legit tagline, a movie review show that isn't just a bunch of straight white dudes. And it isn't, because none of us are. That's our shtick, and we're sticking to it. Yes, it is me, the aforementioned Iffy Wadaway, and then my dear buddy Alonzo Duralde, film critic to the stars. We discuss movies, we discuss motion pictures, we discuss films, and we discuss cinema. As I mentioned, my buddy Alonzo is here, so I have to ask him what I always ask, or if he asks, what's good?
Oh, Drea. Well, I think the stars would disagree about me being the film critic to them, but I appreciate the thought nonetheless. So what's good this week is the announcement from DC Comics that we're getting bisexual Superman, kind of. It's Jonathan Kent, who's actually the son of Clark and Lois, in a very convoluted piece of storytelling that I could not begin to understand because it has been some time since I have picked up a paper and ink comic book or looked at a new one via digital means. But anyway, it's very exciting. It's cool. I'm always down for more inclusivity among the major comics companies. And if it annoys the likes of Dean Cain and various Fox News pundits and right-wing politicians looking for an easy get to be all like, oh, not our Superman. Keep your hands off liberal media. So much the better. So all that is good for me.
That is good. I hope they draw some beautiful love scenes for him. And then I hope someone spray paints those love scenes on walls facing the offices of anyone who's bitching and moaning about it.
Not that we would ever say that that should happen, but it
could.
Oh,
I'm sorry. Yes.
It absolutely could.
Fully sanctioned legal street art. Of
yes,
course.
Yes.
Is what I mean. Yes, we are very lucky to be joined by a friend of the podcast who's been here before, and we're so happy to have him back, writer and director Michael Verratti. What is good?
Well, first off, I just want to say I too am stoked about this Superman news. And for people who are confused, I have been saying this. If you don't know which Superman is which, Clark Kent is the Man of Steel, and John Kent is still your man. So now we have some clarity on what Superman is which. What's good? I'll tell you, it's Halloween season, which is always very good to me. I've been watching a lot of spooky movies, but I do all year round, but I try and kick into some of the more seasonal classics or ones that I haven't touched base with in a while. And I watched Ernest Scared Stupid last night, and I haven't seen it since 1991 or whenever it came out. And it was a journey, but I feel very fulfilled by my return to the world of Ernest P. Worrell.
Is it like a world that you're deeply like, oh, I know every other movie, and so this is the one I came back to? Or had you been like, some were playing at parties? How familiar are you with the Ernest oeuvre?
The Ernest verse, if you will.
The Ernest verse!
I remember kind of the phenomenon of Jim Varney doing this character quite a bit, you know, during that late 80s, early 90s time. And I remember Ernest saved Christmas and he went to camp, and et cetera, et cetera. But these are not things that I have revisited much since that time. But because, of course, Scared Stupid is a Halloween entry and has some spooky things going on. Eartha Kitt's in it as well. I needed to revisit it because I try and watch movies that are set at Halloween, around Halloween. And I know, Alonzo, with the Christmas connection, you understand this.
Oh, I watched Ernest Saves Christmas as an adult for the first time writing my book, and I can say it does hold up.
Well, I felt like Scared Stupid was pretty much still there, too.
All right, let's go on the list.
Spooky. There was a lot of snot in it. Take that as you will.
Is Scared Stupid because it's a Halloween story? Because I heard that title and I assumed it was like the Scared Straight program where they try and keep kids out of prison by terrifying them with the life of criminals.
Although something I guess I forgot about the character of Ernest and Jim Varney is he does kind of a lot of casual drag in the movies too. It's not just Ernest as a character. He plays like Aunt Ernestine and like some of these other characters in like full guiche. So I don't know if you're scaring anyone straight utilizing the teachings of Ernest P. Worrell.
He was a gifted and multi-talented performer. Also, of course, the voice of Slinky Dog in the Toy Story movies. So
yes.
R.I.P. Jim Varney. Drea, what's good?
Okay, mine is not nearly as art or pop culture oriented, but it's starting to get cold in Los Angeles. Again, I say relative to cold.
Cold
in
with
real
an asterisk.
Places. Yes. Sorry, my brethren in Minnesota, it never gets that kind of cold. But the what's good with the cold here is if you have domesticated animals in your home like I do, they get so freaking cute and snuggly when it's cold, and especially if you live in a place that doesn't really have heating, not to brag. My cats are on me like clothing. Like I have like mink stoles and just like wearing them around. They are sitting on me all the time, and that is their job. Like I'm normally annoyed, like I like a truly codependent animal, and this weather really helps that along. So yes, it's good.
They're not there to warm you, Drea. They're there to rob you of your heat.
That's what they think, but joke's on them. I benefit. All right, today's show, we are discussing Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge. We are also going to recast some of our favorite horror killers. And as ever, we will end with staff picks. But to get things started, it is time for our new segment, Itadic, short for Is This Important? Do I Care? Each of us will read a new segment and answer the question, Is This Important? Do I Care? We're going to begin with a story about Iffy Wadaway's very best friend in the world, probably best man at his wedding and vice versa, Timothée Chalamet. It was announced a few months ago that Timothée Chalamet was cast to play a young Willy Wonka in a prequel film simply called Wonka. We discussed it here. This past week, Monsieur Chalamet revealed the first look image of him dressed as Willy Wonka on his Instagram page. In the picture, Mr. Chalamet can be seen wearing a brown top hat, a burgundy coat, and some festive scarves. Thank you, Casey, our producer extraordinaire, with that beautiful description. Now, gents, is this important? Do you care?
As ever, a friend of the show, Louis Vertel, always cuts right to the heart of the matter. And he tweeted, I would be happier about this if the story wasn't Willy Wonka origin story and instead was young Ian McKellen attends first gay club.
Oh, Louis, that's so funny.
I'm really torn apart on this one because on the one hand, like the original Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, cornerstone film of my life, probably the movie I've seen more times than any other, like my absolute favorite. The Wonka bar packaging is the home screen on my phone. I don't want a Wonka sequel. I don't need a Wonka sequel. And I certainly don't want a Wonka remake after the one that Tim Burton perpetrated. On the other hand, if you were to say, look, there is a Wonka prequel happening no matter what, and you can't do a thing about it, but you can pick the director, I would say, okay, then get Paul King, who did Paddington and Paddington 2, which they have. So I just have to sort of lie and wait and see where this thing's going to go.
This photo is my favorite kind of marketing because it's put out in this way as if Timothée just casually had this still from set that went up on his Instagram and not as if it was this carefully choreographed between press and marketing, exactly the image of him looking pensive. And like, literally I think you could see the camera in the foreground and it's like, he's on set. It's all happening. I just love those things when it's supposed
it's so
to be just yeah it's supposed to be yeah. just of the moment of like ooh, and it's on his account, it's not on like the studio's account or something.
Like there weren't memos happening already.
No, I mean they approved it, they had so many conversations about which image, and It just, I love that kind of thing perversely, like the just the machinations of it all. I'm with you. Like, I don't know that I need to see or want to know what led this. The whole setup of it is that this is Willy Wonka before he had his chocolate factory. And I'm like, do we need to know?
I think therein lies the problem, right? When you look at a character, since we were talking about Superman, that's a good place to go back to. Superman's origin is key to us connecting with him. Batman's tragedy is key to us connecting with him. But there are characters, villains specifically, or characters of morally ambiguous gray area that I don't think we need to know a lot about. This weird new propensity of needing to have, like, the villainy explained, the origin explained. And, you know, because we're talking about Nightmare on Elm Street today as well, this thing where we have to explain our monsters. Willy Wonka is not really the hero of the story. He's supposed to be enigmatic, otherworldly, and strange. And that's what makes you fascinated by him. You want to know Charlie's deal. You want to know Charlie's plight because Charlie's our conduit. I don't want to know where Willy Wonka went to school. I don't want to know who Willy Wonka's best friend is. I don't want to know what weird planet of chocolate he came from before here or whatever reason they're going to explain. The thing about Willy Wonka is I'm not supposed to know. I'm supposed to meet him as a dude who does a somersault and then kills a bunch of kids and we love him anyway. That's what I want from Willy Wonka.
Yeah, the enigma is the appeal.
Exactly.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Also because it's going to be a musical and I really want a song about him loving sugar and not like the complicated relationship he has with sugar. But it riffs on like Spoonful of Sugar in some kind of way. I'm just saying, you guys, I'm just riffing. I'm just riffing all the cool things they could do.
I'm sure on the short list for musical Wonka prequel actors was Jake Gyllenhaal. And he recently spoke to Howard Stern about the difficulty of acting in Marvel movies. Gyllenhaal played Mysterio in 2019's Spider-Man Far From Home. And one of the difficulties he spoke about was the ever-changing script throughout production. Quote, that acting is hard, all of it. That world is enormous, and I joined that world way into that run, a train that was already moving. Normally, I come in way early on, and I get to figure it out, unquote. He also spoke about forgetting his lines during a scene and having a minor freakout. Quote, I went up to Tom Holland and was like, dude, help me out. He's like, it's all good, man. Just relax. It was like he was me in so many situations, and I finally did. I just put a lot of pressure on myself because I love that world, unquote. Is this important? Do you care?
Not really. I mean, and I say that I say this with actually, you know, a lot of appreciation for the construction of the MCU and appreciation for the approach to the craft of acting. But what Gyllenhaal is talking about here is kind of strange to me because you really just need to prepare a character. Yes, it's cool if you know the canon. It's cool if you know the history. But the reality is, like, living in a larger world, you're really only going to know as much as you know as a person. So it's sort of like if we are in the greater podcast universe, what Louis Vertel is doing right now, I don't know and probably don't need to know for the sake of this episode. And then when we have big team up where Lewis and I have to beat up Josh Brolin together, then I can know what he's doing. But I think the issue here is he placed a macro issue on really a micro problem. Sure. All Mysterio needs to know is Mysterio. He made it a bigger deal. Tom Holland doesn't seem to really worry about what other people in the MCU are doing based on every interview I've been seeing with him. And that's why he's chill. I think it works.
He's not allowed to know what anyone else is doing because he's gotten in trouble so many times for breaking confidentiality during press junkets. So he's like, oh, nobody tells me anything anymore. So don't worry about it. Don't say anything. I think there's something nice about an actor, like you mentioned, the craft of it, like taking it seriously, even if it's something that could be easily dismissed, like a big ass green screen, huge budget, you know, ridiculousness. And there's something also that people who are not in the mix and don't see it, the idea of having to calibrate performance or that your approach would be different. And that actors, it's very easy from the outside to assume you could act like, oh, anybody, and we've all met a million attractive people in this town who think they can act because they were told that they were attractive. And those two things are not always the same and rarely overlap, actually. But there's something nice about maybe him bringing this up to Howard Stern and like giving to a wider world of, oh no, it's not just like, oh, I memorized my lines and I showed up. Like there's a whole thing of how I approach it, how I go through that. I'm doing work when I do those things, even though you probably just think I put on like a costume and say some lines. And I think any kind of like small appreciation, because you guys, you know, actors rarely get attention or credit.
The poor dears.
Thank God, finally they get to be in the middle for a minute.
I just think, yeah, Michael's right. Don't geek out about the franchise. If you're in the franchise, just go with it. I mean, do you honestly think that, like, you know, Ralph Fiennes was just so into the Harry Potter universe that he was just freaking out on set? I mean, like, no, he showed up, he read the lines, he collected his paycheck, and he went home.
All right. Now, in perfect timing with the release of the Scream 5 trailer, Airbnb has gotten a hold of Sidney Prescott's home from the Scream movies and rented it out to Scary Movie fans. The house is set dressed just like the film in 1996, the original film. When you stay there, you apparently get a virtual check-in from the sheriff, and you can call Ghostface himself if he doesn't call you first. The house is adorned with stab marks and the four previous Scream films on VHS. Alonzo, physical media at its finest. But if you had any interest in staying there, sorry, it's already booked. Whoops. Either way, is this important? Do you care?
Is there Jiffy Pop in the kitchen?
There's no way there's not. They did say that they get like a handful, like trinkets and movie crap or whatever to go with. But then there's also 1990s food and snacks around. There's no way Jiffy Pop is not included in that. And honestly, they should get a refund if it isn't.
Is there a head in the garage door?
Ooh!
I'm like more fascinated by the 90s snacks. Like, is Fruitopia in the fridge? Like,
Gushers?
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh my God. Are 90s snacks?
Remember Orbitz? Not before the travel website. The boba soda.
Oh no no yeah. Well, this is the kind of thing. Obviously, I love again. You guys, the behind the scenes of like marketing. This is a really fun one. Like the idea of teaming up. It's a studio. I mean, like, the studio owns the rights to all of that. They'd be like, come stay at the house that looks like that movie that was scary and used maybe screamed while watching. Like, no, this is a fully authorized by the franchise. And it's, you know, part of the, like, lead up to Scream 5. And this is the kind of fun thing I love. Like, I'll pay into that. I'll give lip service to it. I wish I could stay there, but it did sell out in like a heartbeat.
It's like that guy who bought the house that they used to shoot the exteriors in A Christmas Story and redid the interior to look like the movie, which was actually shot inside of a studio. And you can actually, like, you can spend Christmas Eve night there. Like, one lucky person gets to do that every year. And there's like and they opened a museum next door. So, yeah, I'm all for, fully interactive, you know, movie experiences, especially given, like, you know, we talked about Los Angeles Plays itself a while back. And heaven knows it's not like we can just go waltzing into Richard Neutra houses because, oh, this is where the bad guy in LA Confidential lived, you know.
My favorite story of a filmmaker owning the house themselves is Oren Peli owning the house from Paranormal Activity. And then they shot he made so much money just making them like pay him for that house for the sequels and everything. Brilliant. Filmmakers, take note. Think of the marketing potential. Five films 20 years later.
Well, people just love the ability to kind of check into the fantasy for a bit. I live.
Is that on there? Check into the fantasy for a bit. Get this guy a job with Airbnb.
No, I live not far from the house that was used as the exterior of the Brady Bunch. And so I see people quite regularly swing on by. Like, I'll be on my walk, and when you see a car going slow in the neighborhood, you're always like, it's over there, because there aren't people back in the neighborhood for no reason. That's usually right. Like, if they don't know where they're going, that's where they're going. And I don't know that, like, I would want to drop the money to spend a night in the Scream house, but if I was driving by, would I want to take a photo outside? Absolutely. So I get it. And I think that this is the kind of thing that, as a film fan, with exterior locations, you can go do, and you can go, like you, like Alonzo said, we can't hang out on the Paramount lot. We can't live on the set at Warner Brothers. But if you can go look at the house from whatever happened to Baby Jane or from the Brady Bunch or from Scream.
I live
Scream,
near, you know? Near the Nightmare on Elm Street house that we'll be talking about tonight. That's not far from where I live. And definitely people take pictures of it all the time. And the people who own it seem to be cool. And I've heard people who've gone to like Laura Palmer's house in Washington State, and the owner will actually come out and talk to you about it and stuff. So it depends. I think the Brady Bunch house, the people that owned it for years, changed the facade to discourage tourists. But then they then HGTV, you know, bought the house and did everything they could to make it as Brady-ish as possible. So obviously now it is. Yeah, Michael, I'm sure all the more people driving through your neighborhood because it's going to look the way it's supposed to look for them.
Boy, does it. All right. We are going to take a break. But when we come back, we will be talking about Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge.
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. We get our cars tuned up to prevent bigger issues down the road. We get annual checkups and go to the gym to maintain physical wellness and prevent injury and disease. Going to therapy is like all of the above. It's routine maintenance for your mental and emotional wellness to prevent bigger issues down the road. Therapy doesn't mean something's wrong with you. It means you're investing in yourself to keep your mind healthy.
BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It can be more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can start communicating with your therapist in under 48 hours. Why invest in everything else and not in your mind? This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and Maximum Film listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/maxfilm. That's BETTERHELP.com/MAXFILM.
I'm Lisa Hannawalt.
And I'm Emily Heller.
9 years ago, we started a podcast to try and learn something new every episode.
Things have gone a little off the rails since then. Tune in to hear about
low-stakes neighborhood drama,
gardening,
the sordid, nasty underbelly of the horse girl lifestyle,
hot sauce,
addiction to TV, and sweaty takes on celebrity culture,
and the weirdest, grossest stuff you can find on Wikipedia.org.
We'll read all of it, no matter how gross. There's something for everyone on our podcast, Baby Geniuses.
Hosted by us, two horny adult idiots.
Hang out with us as we try and fail to retain any knowledge at all.
Every other week on Maximum Fun. Baby Geniuses, tell us something we don't know.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Drea Clark. In the studio with me are
Alonzo Duraldi
and Michael Verratti.
And today we are talking about Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge. I try and say it different every time because, you know, it just really wants to like, do it. Alonzo, would you mind providing a brief synopsis?
Oh, sure. And for starters, I want to apologize a little bit up front just because I know last week when we had Sam Wyman on to talk about Butcher Baker, Nightmare Maker, he sort of in passing referred to this as being kind of the basic bitch of horror, gay horror movies. And I know it is, but I think there's always more to talk about, and especially in context of another movie that came out recently that we'll get into. So that's why we're doing this. If you're rolling your eyes thinking, oh God, not another queer discussion of this movie. But yes, it is another queer discussion of this movie. So this is the follow-up to the first smash hit Nightmare on Elm Street movie. Mark Patton stars as Jesse Walsh. He and his family have moved into the house. They got a deal on it. They have no idea why. And things are still going nuts in there. Jesse is having horrible nightmares involving Freddy Krueger, and Freddy is basically saying that Jesse is going to be the conduit to which he will return to the world.
You've got the body. I've got the brain.
Not if Jesse's girlfriend Lisa has anything to say about it, but even though Jesse does have a girlfriend and she does play a major role in the film, this movie is soaking in queer subtext and even text from beginning to end, whether it is Jesse's close, intimate friendship with hunky Robert Russler as Ron Grady.
Hey, Grady, you remember your dreams? Only the wet ones.
Closeted, viciously queer gym coach.
Okay, dirtballs, hit the shower.
Who gets a towel snapped to death by Freddy in a shower room. Or the probe game in Jesse's closet. Or the fact that Jesse has a closet. Look, there's a lot of things going on here.
An entire scene involving Jesse's closet.
We are still unpacking them, and that's what we're going to do here tonight.
I just want you to know that as an extra layer to this queer reading, I'm going to be bringing the oblivious hetero visuals that I had. I loved the Nightmare on Elm Street movies when I was young. Like, I had a pack of girlfriends, and we did slumber parties like every weekend, every other weekend. These were our movies. I watched all of these so many, like in seventh grade, right? Like, somebody must have owned them. There's no way we were renting them this much. Watched them so many times. Ladies, did I ever once see anything gay about it? No, I did not. Was I probably already going through puberty and should have, but I also wasn't really clocking. Like, when I rewatched it, I was like, Robert Russler's in this? Because definitely later on, I bonered for him in Shag. So the level of things that flew over my idiot head as a, like, preteen is, I'd say, almost shocking if it were surprising in any way. Alas, it is not.
Except, you know, I think that that's a very popular read of this movie, and I think that's a good way to begin discussion of it, because looking at A Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2, Freddy's Revenge, in 2021, and all of the things in it, all of the things that Alonzo described, we're seeing this movie, and it's hard for us to think, how did people not see that this was such a queer film? But when the movie came out, following on the heels of the original Elm Street, and it was released to mainstream America, queer discussion in media, the way that we do now, was virtually non-existent. And so, yes, there are probably people in coastal cities or metropolitan areas that see a leather bar and are like, oh, that's a gay bar. But for folks in the Midwest who have no context for this, people like my parents, people like aunts and uncles of mine, they see a biker bar. They see things. They found ways to compartmentalize and not see the queerness in this movie that was so apparent to queer people. But because it was not part of the cultural discussion, that's why it sort of went overlooked. And for a lot of people, it just felt sort of a sore thumb in the franchise, not for gay reasons, but because it just didn't fit in with the rest of them. And it wasn't until later, when a lot of film scholars started unpacking it, that we were like, yeah, it's really gay. But that plausible deniability was so part of its trajectory for so long that members of the crew, Jack Shoulder, the director of this movie, has said numerous times that he didn't see the gayness of it until years later when someone had to point it out to him.
Yeah, I was going to, the other movie that I was referencing before is the documentary Scream Queen about Mark Patton and about this film, which came out in the last couple of years. And I think that really marked the turning point at which the director and writer had to be like, after years of denial, yeah, okay, we knew what we were doing, or at least we had an inkling of what we were doing. And part of it was because they thought it was interesting, sort of subtextual kind of, you know, whatever, or a way to freak out, you know, the straight guys who were the target audience for horror movies. And then also the fact because, like, Mark Patton as a gay actor, you know, the movie is treating him like a final girl. He screams in a way that no man ever screams in horror movies in this movie. But that Jamie Lee Curtis absolutely did. Like, that kind of thing. He is visually and physically objectified in a way in this movie that women frequently are in slasher movies, but men never are. I think it does loan itself to that reading. I mean, weirdly enough, I don't have a giant affection for, I mean, I'm not a big horror guy, so I guess it's not a surprise, but like, there are entire chunks of the Nightmare franchise that I've never seen, but I've seen this one like five times now, just because I keep getting involved in these conversations, whether at film festivals or on podcasts. And on that level, I just find it kind of fascinating because, yeah, 1985, Reagan is in office, you know, the AIDS pandemic is really starting to hit hard. And as such, like, queer everything is being just kind of swept out of any sort of mainstream, you know, cultural visibility. Queer actors are you know, hiding in the closet or like not getting roles even, you know, because of you know, perceptions about how they read on screen or what people might know about their personal life. And so, yeah, this movie kind of occupies this weird space of being precisely of that moment, but also kind of simultaneously commenting upon that moment in a way that nobody in that moment, as you said, with the exception of a few coastal elite observers, were even noticing.
Well, what I do want to say real quick, just back to the whole plausible deniability and how a lot of people who worked on this movie were not aware of the subtext and the overt text, is what seems so obvious to us is this thing that they just were not facing at the time is... when you go to that bar, the bartender at that bar is played by Bob Shea, who is the executive producer of the Elm Street franchise. This is his cameo in the franchise.
The guy who ran New Line.
Yeah. Nice. And he was like, I'm going to be in these movies. And he's the bartender at this S&M gay bar. But I guarantee that Bob Shea was not fully like firing on all cylinders, thinking about the fact that, oh, I'm the bartender at the gay bar. He's just like, I just get to be tough and wear leather. That's cool.
Oh, yeah.
And then later. So I think there's so much to unpack. As for the coach, I think to look at the character of the coach, you have to sort of look at the macro queerness of this movie, because in the kind of greater discussion of queer horror and queer cinema, this movie kind of... frequently gets referred to as the gayest movie of all time, with a little tongue-in-cheek humor from genre fans. And it has been embraced in a way that, say, Cruising or Basic Instinct has after the fact. But the overall messaging of this movie isn't necessarily pro-queer when you think about it. I mean, we like all the queer things about it. We like to see a boy as a scream queen. We like to see this kind of overt gayness in a time when there was none. But the message of the movie is still that this is a bad thing. This is a subversive thing, that the overwhelming love of this girl will push this terrible thing that he has inside of him out, and then he can be normal. Freddie is the gay that needs to be vanquished out of him so that he can live a happy life. And so to have the coach represent this sort of subversive queerness that goes to this like seedy S&M bar that lures the young boys in, of course that's how he's represented, because the script is basically setting up that if you go down this path, this is the life that you lead. And it's not a good one. Mm-hmm. Versus if you go home to Lisa, she's going to smooch Freddie out of you and all is going to be great.
While looking a lot like Meryl Streep.
A lot like Meryl
a
Streep.
A lot real Streep energy from young Lisa. Alonzo, how about you? Did you have any?
I mean, that's absolutely true. I mean, I think that, you know, yeah, there has been something of a revisionism for Cruising, A, because that entire sort of world, that element of New York City has been destroyed both by AIDS and by, you know, just... what's the thing when neighborhoods
gentrification.
Thank you. Yes. The meat market district is not what it used to be. And so, you know, it's almost taken on this sort of like ethnographic documentary thing in terms of like, this no longer exists, but we captured it on film for this one special moment, you know? But yeah, you're right. I mean, pretty much there is the explicit implication here that the only clearly queer character is this sadistic coach who's awful to the kids, who smokes in his office, which even for 1985 for a gym teacher seemed like a bit much. He gets a gay death almost, and then like it's about getting his ass smacked, you know. And you're right, it is about like, oh, but this young woman is going to save, you know, our fair-haired, literally, you know, hero from the pits of degradation. So there is that element to it. But I mean, I think that, you know, sometimes we can still be fascinated by something, even if even if we read it as homophobic, just because at least they're talking about us.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, I think there's certainly plenty of Hollywood classics where we might sort of cringe at how they describe, you know, queer lives or queer sexuality. But just, the, you know, at least we're being represented. At least we're on the screen.
Right. And to be clear, I do love this movie, but I do think that it's important when discussing the film as this sort of like the pinnacle, if you will, of gay horror movies. As you said, it was referenced as the basic bitch choice. It's because it's the one everyone talks about. But let's not, you know, sugarcoat the fact that it's like necessarily the best representation. I love this movie and I love seeing Mark dance and I love Freddie being the Ethel Merman of horror that he is.
Oh my gosh.
but it's still not necessarily the greatest example of queerness that you could maybe get.
I'm glad you brought up all of that. And I'd love to dig into the movie more because even outside of the subjects, like, for me, when, you know, my pack of friends and we had our thing, we would also rank these all the time. This one was always either my second or third favorite. And one of the reasons I loved it so much as a 12 or 13 year old girl, I loved the strong female lead. I've got a real soft spot for a sensitive boy. Like, there's all sorts of things in this that I found meaningful, but it was also because we were pretty well versed in the world building of Nightmare on Elm Street. This one is such a strange ass one because Freddy like enters the real world in a way. And I think any part of me that was maybe no part of me was wondering if there was subtext. I was real, real smart. There was something about the first one I knew, like, oh, the scare, like the whole idea of like, I can't go to sleep and how terrifying that seemed. And if you go to sleep, he'll get you. And this, there was just like so many strange crossovers. So I'd love to get into that because the implications here too, not only can Freddy and he, you know, that's the whole point. He wants to use Jesse so he can get into the real world, but that also that's scary to me. But almost more scary is there's one instance where he gets into Jesse's body. He does damage to someone else out of Jesse's body. And then he leaves Jesse to deal with it. And I was like, that's my biggest nightmare. You want a nightmare on my street? It is me being blamed for the brutal killing of my friend.
With my fingerprints and DNA all over the
right?
place.
Right. Like, above and beyond it. Like, I don't know if this really fits the sort of mythology of Freddy Krueger, but that was like genuinely scary to me, that concept, like in a philosophical way.
Well, absolutely. And it kind of goes back to that final moment where Lisa is supposed to push Freddy out of Jesse. I mean, if you look at something like The Exorcist, the idea that the demon inside of Reagan is a separate entity is allegedly at play here, but not really, because it's sort of established that Freddy and Jesse at a certain point are one and the same because Freddy is representative of this thing that Jesse does not want to be. And that's also why it's sort of counter the rest of the Elm Street franchise, you know, because this is not a nightmare in the traditional sense of you go to bed. Freddy is Jesse's gay nightmare. He is like the thing that like the sexuality that he does not want to be, but is dot, 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 et cetera, blah, blah, blah. And this is something that doesn't come up a lot that I when asked to talk about this movie and this franchise, I like to beat this drum because I think it's time to recontextualize the conversation. We always think of part two as the gay one. When in reality, the Elm Street franchise as a whole is the gay one. And if you track the way the movies are structured, in the first one, Nancy is othered. Nobody believes her, so she has to rely on herself. She has to rely on her otherness and her own personal sense of strength to fight back against Freddy. That can be a queer narrative. All of the reasons we discussed too is a queer narrative. If you look at the Dream Warriors who have to find their chosen family and draw strength on the community and how that overarcs into Dream Master, those are queer narratives. They're always fighting this big deep fried drag queen every movie, and they're relying on their otherness, they're relying on their chosen family, and they're relying on the power of their community. Elm Street is the gay one, period. It just so happens that part two is the one that majored in musical theater.
I think you said it all when you said that Freddy Krueger is the Ethel Merman of killers, because it's so true. Okay, before we go, I do want desperately to hear what our beautiful baby boy, Iffy Wadaway, had to say about this. Casey, I know you got that audio. Can you please play it for us?
How y'all doing? very sorry I couldn't be there. I'm in Austin this week shooting some stuff. And, I couldn't miss up a chance to drop my thoughts. You know, I wasn't going to leave y'all hanging. I know you were thinking, because this is probably pretty close to a lot of the horniness level that I prefer in my film, my cinema. So just right out the gate, I'm going to just let you know, real big fan of the movie. Lots of questions. And some of the questions I had answered, like my main question being like, yo, this is the house where literally the same thing happened in the previous movie. How didn't anyone notice? But sure enough, it turns out the father has hidden it from his family, and high schoolers for some reason didn't tell this guy, like, yo, you living in that murder house, bro? But you know, I was rocking with it. Now, the homoeroticism off the charts in this movie. I mean, let's not talk about the scene where he runs away from badly giving foreplay to his dream girl to try and hop in bed with his buff hunk of a friend. And on the subject of that scene, I've never considered kissing, licking, and sucking between the boobs. But you know, ladies, if I've been goofing, if I've been wrong about that, let me know. Because, you know, I usually try and focus on the boobs or, you know. Anyway, I'm definitely going to say this is a screen it. This is, once again, one of those films I'd put up that I think would be great to see in a classic theater like the Los Feliz 3 or something or the other to watch for the spooky season. It's a good time. I'm kind of sad I couldn't be there to hear the full details of how we feel about the coach, because I'm definitely seeing what Sam was talking about. Like, I don't know exactly what was going to happen after that shower, but it seems like it wasn't good. You know, but I don't want to assume. Yeah, it was a wild ride. Like it. Definitely screen it for me. And I miss y'all already. I'm going to imagine that Drea has her hair in a real big poofy style in honor of the movie. Alonzo still has books behind him. And Casey has, for some reason, decided to wear a beret again. Those are my Zoom box, you know, assumptions, predictions, whatever you want to call it. Have a great show. I'll see y'all next week.
Well, I'd like to say, as the resident boob haver, anyone wondering about the taint between the boobs, you're fine. You're fine not giving that much attention. Okay. Stick to the goods themselves. That's it's an unnecessary, you know, sort of.
And people say you don't learn things from podcasts.
Yeah, exactly. I will say my guess of what I thought if he was going to go on about was how hot Hope Lang was as the mother in this. For those of us who know her from Peyton Place, mm-hmm. when she was a teenager, I was like, who is that stunning 50-something woman? Like, stunning. And then looked it up and was like, that is not Hope Lang. I truly expected Iffy to, and I'm pretty sure if I even made a slight mention of it, I would hear an entire sonnet from him about her hotness. So
I will say Clue Gulliger, like, you know, even in the 80s, yeah. Still yeah. keeping it fresh, looking good.
Clue Gulliger, classic. Classic of the genre.
The greatest
thing. Yeah. All right. So if he started us off, but let's get into our final reviews of Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge. Would you screen it, stream it, or skip it? Alonzo, how about we start with you?
I think I'm a stream it. Because I don't have a giant franchise knowledge here, I find a lot of this stuff to be kind of cheeseball in terms of, I mean, like, I think that whole beginning bus effect with the chasm, I thought a lot of it just looked really crappy. My favorite of the Nightmare movies is actually Wes Craven's New Nightmare, just because I think the peeling away of the layers of artifice make the whole thing scarier when you think it's happening to actual, you know, Wes Craven, Heather Langenkamp, and Robert Englund. But, you know, I think this is an interesting sort of asterisk in queer horror. Obviously, since 1985, we have a lot more queer filmmakers who get to make their own queer horror movies. So the idea of this being the gayest movie ever, I don't think really applies anymore if it ever did. But it definitely worth a look, and definitely, I think, loans itself to analysis and discussion. So I'll say stream it.
If you ever come across someone who refers to this as the gayest movie ever, send them our way. We have plenty of other recommendations for them, as does our guest. So, Michael, what's your final review on Freddy's Revenge?
I would screen it because, one, I love seeing the Elm Street movies in a theater. I think movies of this kind are always best with an audience. My dear friend and frequent collaborator, Peaches Christ, and I love to talk about how cult films are really made by the cult, right? And, you know, horror, especially of this era, has that certain communal aspect to it. And I have been quite lucky to have seen most of the Elm Street movies many times over theatrically, and they always feel a little bit like a rock concert. This one plays particularly well these days because the audience is now in on it. They know. They understand the big pride, you know, flag that it is, that audiences then didn't quite see and why it sort of got derided for a bit. And it's been really cool to also see Mark Patton have a reclamation of this movie. And this movie that really was not so great for him becoming a really kind of powerful part of his legacy in the long run and how he's turned that around. So I would say, yeah, I want to see it in a theater. I want to see it with fellow devotees, and maybe Mark will come in and give him a talking to as well.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I must screen it as well. I think this is fun. Obviously, I love all of them. My dream is actually to watch all of the Nightmare on Elm Streets in a row again, like the old days, and possibly while in my sleeping bag that looked like a box of crayons. Again, if you're looking for the level of cool that I was existing at, it was that. So, yeah. There we go. That has been our discussion on Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge. Stick with us. We will be right back after a short break.
A man was walking along a beach which represented his life. At his feet were two sets of footprints, his and God's. But looking back down the beach, the man could see that in the hardest parts of his life, there was only one set of footprints. So the man said to God, "Why is there only one set of footprints when times were hard? Where were you?" And God replied, "My precious child, I was in my car listening to the Beef and Dairy Network podcast." The Beef and Dairy Network podcast is a multi-award-winning comedy podcast, and you can find it at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Drea Clark. In the studio with me are
Alonzo Duraldi
and Michael Verratti.
Since we're discussing Senior Freddy Krueger, we are going to take some time to recast some classic killers with different actors. So basically, gents, we own a studio. We have the rights to everything. Great news. Massive funding. We have rights to everything, so that's not it. And of course, as a new studio with rights to everything, we're not going to do original content. We're going to do remakes.
Oh, heavens, yeah. IP, yeah, baby.
Yeah, we want that hot, hot remake action. So I'm going to give you killers' names, and then we're going to recast that role with modern, currently alive actors.
Great.
So
Timothée Chalamet as Willy Wonka. No, sorry, okay.
Uh-huh. I mean, that's a horror character in a way.
It's truly, truly.
And we don't know those kids aren't dead.
That's what I'm saying. You know, really.
Gloop is dead.
The original,
Augustus Gloop, dead.
Yeah, the Gene Wilder movie follows a slasher movie formula. I'm just saying. Watch it again.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Charlie's the final girl.
Exactly.
Oh, my God, so good. Okay, so obviously the first killer that we're going to start with, tip of the hat to old Ethel Merman himself, Freddy Krueger. Who are we bringing in as the new Freddy Krueger? I mean, like, obviously, if we could get Robert Englund, we would, because, you know, if sure. It ain't broke.
Right.
But let's just say it's broke. We're going to fix it. Who would play? Because, again, Robert Englund, what he did with that, like, there's a whole lot going on with Freddy Krueger that many others would not have tried. Like,
and we're disqualifying Jackie Earle Haley, who actually did play Freddy in the attempted reboot of the franchise.
Yeah, yeah. We're a whole new studio. We don't want another dirty reboot on us.
I mean, here's the thing. The evolution of Freddy over the course of this thing is really interesting because he begins as a horrifically burned child molester and murderer, and by the end is like America's wisecracking sweetheart. And so I'm wondering if do we want to lean on the one-liners from the get-go, or do we want to go for a more sinister character, and then if the humor emerges later, then so be it.
I feel like humor, and there's also like a physicality to Freddy.
Right.
And now, the humor's crucial. Yeah, Michael.
I have thoughts on this because I have long, you know, thought who would be great for the new Freddy. And I, you know, at one point, Kevin Bacon did make his intentions known that he would like to play Freddy Krueger. And I could see Kevin Bacon doing it, but I think the theatricality is key. And I don't think it has to be one or the other, because comedy and horror are really two sides of the same coin. It's, you know, all about controlling the audience's breathing. Like, you can affect a laugh or you can affect a scream. So I want somebody who's weird and funny, but has the propensity to be creepy. And so for me, Freddy Krueger has to be played by Amy Sedaris.
Oh my God, I love it so much. I was thinking Jim Carrey, and then you turned to the corner to Amy Sedaris, and now I'm never going back. Keep me on this street, Elm Street.
Yeah,
oh my God.
I can't top that one. No. But yeah, now, no, I can picture, I think, her checks all the boxes for sure. Can she dance? Just because I think there needs to be like a fluidity of movement here. What if maybe like Doug Jones plays the role and then does the mocap, and then Amy Sedaris does the vocalizing?
Any kind of combo there. I love that. I'm very excited. That's the out of the box thinking we're looking for at the studio. That's why you're an exec here.
You'll go far.
Thank you.
Well done. All right. So the next one is both a listing and a title as well as a character. We're going to remake Single White Female, you guys. Mm. And of course, the original played by Bridget Fonda. No, Bridget Fonda played the roommate. Yes. Jennifer Jason Lee played the single white female who becomes obsessed, wants to take over. So who do we, I know there was sort of a Leighton Meester kind of, but again, we don't want their bad takes. We want the fresh new hotness for single white female. Who do we see here? We're looking for a very intense, creepy woman, but has to be sort of guileless at first, or, you know, she's got to get in the door.
What if Elle Fanning plays the stalker of Dakota Fanning?
Would
double
Fanning. 100%. Yeah, double Fanning.
Yeah.
Oh my God. And you chose the right ones
and
as well.
She transforms herself over the course of the film to be more Dakota-like.
Oh my God. L being creeper, would what? Again, this is why you got a corner office, Alonzo. Both of you, very happy to have you here. All right. So the next one is a physical presence more than a performative vocal one. Okay. But I still think it's crucial. And I do think we want to do something interesting here. Like, if we're thinking broader marketing, whatever, who do we want for Michael Myers? You know, people barely talk about that anymore. Certainly, there aren't two new of those movies coming out in the next 2 years. So it's on us to refigure this out.
Well, he's a silent but strong type. You got to have a good stare, right? Like, maybe Michael Shannon?
I was totally thinking Michael Shannon.
God. Michael Shannon, and he definitely needs scenes without the William Shatner mask.
Yes.
So that you could see that even without the mask, he's still doing that stare.
Doesn't need it. Doesn't need the mask.
It's just as like, I don't. Then you want to go back and forth of like, put the mask back on. Oh, no, my God, take the mask off.
I mean, maybe does he even need a mask? This could be the art. This could be Michael Shannon is Michael Myers in Jim Jarmusch's Halloween. Done.
All right. We're going to need to really pair Jarmusch with some VFX specialists. But yeah, we can make this happen. We got all the money. Like I mentioned, we got all the money in the world.
As long as his slasher movie is better than his zombie movie.
Yeah. His zombie. Okay. So our next one, we have another strong female role. This is a character that was mentioned by me in our Would You Rathers last week. So you guys, we're not going to have our new studio and not do a Stephen King adaptation. So who is our new Annie Wilkes? The Kathy Bates role from Misery, made famous by her the assumption that this woman is just going to be so benign and helpful, but is actually insane.
I don't know why Ginger Minj is the first thing that came to mind, so I'm going to let Alonzo go with this one.
I would watch Ginger Minj happily play Annie Wilkes. Yes.
Well, I think the gimme here would be like Anne Dowd, but I'm saying let's, you know, we're all about thinking outside of the box here at this studio.
Oh, what you want to do is put Sarah Paulson in a fat suit? Is that what you're thinking outside?
No. I'm going to go even further outside. I'm thinking Viola Davis.
Ooh, she'd be great.
She could scare the crap out of you if she gave the slightest effort.
Misery's second Oscar.
Yeah.
Ah, it really, truly would be. Has Viola Davis done genre?
I mean, she stared down Meryl Streep in Doubt. I'll count that.
Right. Wasn't she in that witch movie that no one saw?
Beautiful Creatures?
Yeah.
Oh, she's maybe. All I remember about that movie is Margot Martindale holding a peacock, and that's all I need to know about that
movie.
Which,
by the way, Margot Martindale in Misery is not a terrible choice either.
Oh, no, yeah.
But that's I figured, more on the
nose. She and Anne Dowd, I figured, top of the list, no problem. But, do we count Widows as a genre film? Because, I mean, there was that. I
think she'd be fantastic.
Yeah, I think because, you know, she... You have to remember, like, Kathy Bates going into that was, you know, she was best known for doing Frankie and Johnny and the Clair de Lune on Broadway. It's not like she had these horror bona fides, but she is an imposing presence as an actress and brought all of that to bear. And I think Viola Davis, like, with her, you know, just, like, dressed down and just super rabidly, intensely focused on everything that's going on in front of her, that would just be super chilling, I think.
I'm super excited. I can see the money already, which, as you know, I'm more interested than art. So well done. Okay. I definitely want to hear your thoughts on, you guys don't know this, but not only are we remaking American Psycho, but we are bringing on the original production team because they need the justice. Who's playing Patrick Bateman? Who is stepping into the Huey Lewis News's shoes of Patrick Bateman?
Ugh, I mean, I want to see Idris Elba just do the push-ups, but...
That's another movie entirely.
I know it is. I mean, the thing is about Patrick Bateman is in a way, it's got to be a similar type because of how Bret Easton Ellis wrote the character. He's got to be such a yuppie, you know, I don't know. I can't remember from a lot of swear on the show. So you know what I mean.
Fill in the blank.
Yeah.
A yuppie piece of shit.
Exactly. That.
I'm trying to think of like who is capable of just, who is either already blandly handsome or could easily just sort of be blandly handsome. Like probably somebody who's on a sitcom right now. How about like the kid on Young Sheldon? Is he old enough yet?
The kid on Young Sheldon. Hold on, let me get my assistant on the... Someone get me the kid from Young Sheldon's agent.
To play Patrick Bateman.
To play Patrick Bateman. Yeah. I love that so much.
Or the kid from the kid from Modern Family who like sprouted up 2 feet in the middle of the... toward the end of the show. Like maybe him.
The kid who played Luke?
Yes.
Yeah. I feel like you do. There is such
somebody
a...
Somebody who's approachably TV, you know, likable. That I think that's what you want to go with.
TV likable, but there is such a feral, urbane quality to Patrick Bateman as well.
So Jane Krakowski.
Jane Krakowski is Patrick Bateman. Yeah. It would really open the door. There, we can have our own subtext on what's going on with that character. A whole analysis. I feel really good about this slate. I'm very excited about these movies, and I'm even more excited about the money we're going to make. So good job, you guys.
Hooray for Hollywood.
We did it. All right, now it is time for staff picks. It can be any movie at all in the whole wide world. Alonzo, why don't you start?
Well, this is a sub pick, but I mentioned it in passing earlier. The documentary Scream Queen about Mark Patton is now streaming on Shudder and AMC Plus, and it is, I think, no further discussions of Nightmare on Elm Street 2 can take place that don't include discussions of this documentary, because I think it really kind of puts a kind of a button on certain things about the making of the film and the aftermath of the film. And so absolutely, there are two things that should be watched in tandem. My staff pick this week, though, is dropping today, in theaters and on Apple TV Plus, and it is Todd Haynes' documentary, The Velvet Underground. Haynes has never made a documentary before, but he is really good at it and has made a film that is formally perfect for the subject that he's covering and the story that he's telling. It really allows audiences to understand the sort of what American society was like that the New York avant-garde was responding to. So much of the filmmaking technique that he uses in giving us the sort of, you know, interviews and talking heads and stock footage and that kind of thing you expect in a documentary that's set, you know, 50, 60 years ago, borrows from very intentionally like Andy Warhol's split screens from the Chelsea Girls, or things that Jonas Mekas, who was interviewed in the film, does. And he was a very major player in this sort of like mid-60s avant-garde art, and specifically in terms of the Warhol factory and even the Velvet Underground, you know, in particular. So it's a fascinating film. It's illuminating. I knew a little about The Velvet Underground, but not a ton. And much like Edgar Wright's The Sparks Brothers documentary from earlier this year, I came away maybe not necessarily running out to buy all their albums, but with a fuller understanding of who they were, why they matter, and why what specifically people who love them get out of their work. So whatever your feelings about The Velvet Underground, or if you don't know who the fucking Velvet Underground even were, see Todd Haynes's new documentary. It's great.
Nice. Michael, how about you?
Well, in the spirit of avant-garde and queer cinema, I am going to suggest that people who want to continue down the train of watching queer horror movies look ahead now to more modern day, and to a little film from France a couple years ago called Knife Plus Heart, directed by Jan Gonzalez.
Yes, yes.
It is a queer giallo film, and what I think is really key in discussing this movie is that it is 100% queer. When you look at Nightmare on Elm Street 2, you're looking at queerness through the confines and lens of the straight society it's bucking up against. And alternatively, Jan Gonzalez makes this queer slasher, you know, homage to Dario Argento films, that the whole movie's queer. That every character is steeped in a queerness that you don't really ever take time to consider the queerness or the queer context of the film, because that's just part of it when you enter. And then you get to just enjoy this kind of singular thing that we haven't really been given in the space up until that point. And I love it. I mean, it's violent and crazy and maybe a little inaccessible at parts, but that's what makes it great. That's what makes it a giallo. And yeah.
Plus, such a good title.
Seconded. Yes. Great
That's
movie.
A great title. All right, so I of course have a recommendation that is neither horror nor queer, because what's a theme, huh? But there's a film coming out this weekend in theaters called Bergman Island.
Yay.
That I highly recommend. It is a festival film from this year. It premiered at Cannes. It is by the director Mia Hansen-Love, who is Swedish, Danish.
Scandinavian is my fallback when I don't know.
Scandinavian. But it takes place in the island where Ingmar Bergman shot a ton of his films and projects, and they're there for like a festival around his work. The main couple is Vicky Creeps, that we loved from Phantom Thread, and Tim Roth. They are a pair of filmmakers who are there. So there's a lot of meta commentary about Bergman as a filmmaker and relationships through the Bergman lens, but also, so you can know nothing about his work. You could just have watched the new Scenes from a Marriage and be interested in learning more about the original creator. Or you could be a terrific fan and pick up all sorts of things. So it's a great movie on its own, but it's especially interesting as this really unique viewpoint from a French director. Thank you, Casey. Oh, no. This is what I get. I'm just like, she's not American. Ugh, I'm the worst. All right. Before we go, we have two big announcements. So, in celebration of the Maximum Fun Black Party, we recorded a joint mini episode with the McElroy brothers from My Brother, and Me.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, we sure did. The mini episode is dropping on October 19th. I laughed a whole lot while recording it. I'm sure you will when you listen. If you are already subscribed to this here podcast, you'll get it automatically. We discussed the best and worst advice we learned from movies. So really, it's an educational experience. And then next week on our regular episode, we are talking about 2014's Lyle with comedy writer Monica Vasandani. Thank you, Michael. Thanks for coming back and being on the show, talking about this movie that you know more about than anyone else in the whole world. We're very lucky to have had you. Is there anything you'd like to plug?
Well, first and foremost, that's very kind of you to say. I would say that Mark Patton owns the rights of knowing more about this movie than anyone else, followed by Roman Kimienti and Tyler Jensen, who made the documentary Scream Queen. But I'll take an earnest fourth place on that
okay.
one.
Okay. Very gentlemanly.
Yeah, you know, luckily Halloween in October is sort of my time of year. I've got a lot of projects kind of coming out, but the most immediate things where you can see my work include the Boulay Brothers' Dragula, which is premiering on Shudder on October 19th. Ooh. I work as one of the directors on the show. I direct all the intros and death sequences. So if you see a drag queen going down, that's my handiwork. And speaking of drag queens, I have returned to the podcast sphere by co-hosting a show called Midnight Mass with my dear friend Peaches Christ, where every week we do kind of deep dives on cult movies and figures, where we go beyond just the movie and into the phenomena. So, for example, we did an episode on Brian De Palma's Phantom of the Paradise, and we talked not only about the movie, but how when the movie came out, it was a failure everywhere, but curiously, not in the city of Winnipeg, where it was number one for 18 weeks.
Yes.
That's great.
So we spoke to some Canadian fans, and it's been great because Peaches and I are longtime fans of cult cinema, and it's allowing us to understand the cults that inform us. And it's been a really great adventure. And we're getting ready to do a live show soon that I'm hoping I can announce.
Nice.
Probably right. later this fall.
Where can people keep up with their Michael Verratti news online?
The best place to keep up with me is just on Twitter, at Michael Verratti. If you want to know what's going on with Midnight Mass, it's at Midnight Mass Pod. As far as Dragula, the Boulay brothers are everywhere, so you can probably find them. And yeah, just keep your eyes open.
Awesome. Thank you for being here. Now, if you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at maximum_film. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebookgroup.com/group/maximumfilm. Or send us an email at maximumfilm@maximumfun.org. Our sweet elf and baby boy producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer that I'll come up with cute nicknames for once I see him is Kevin Ferguson. And this is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.